Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I often have a smile on my face because I feel incredibly privileged to live in such a fantastic country. Australia's got a tremendous amount to be proud of, both on the health front and the economic front. So I think we should all remember that and try to keep a smile on our face when we can. I want to thank you, Michael, for the invitation to be part of this summit once again. It's great to be here in person. I'd also like to congratulate you on the AFR's 70th anniversary. 70 years in an industry that's undergone so much change is quite an achievement, so well done, and I look forward to many more years of excellent finance and business reporting. As you would have heard yesterday, the timing of this summit coincides with a lift in sentiment about the global economy. The rapid development of vaccines and their rollout has improved the global outlook, and it's lessened some of the downside risks. The plan for further stimulus in the United States has also improved growth prospects there. The result of this has been a reassessment by investors of the outlook for inflation and the outlook for interest rates around the world. Against this backdrop, I'd like to begin today by reviewing recent economic and financial developments. I will then turn to the importance of business investment in sustaining a strong economic recovery. And finally, I'll discuss the outlook for monetary policy in Australia. Last week, we received further confirmation that the Australian economy is recovering very well and better than expected. As you can see, hopefully, in my first chart, would show, as you know, that GDP increased by 3.1% in the December quarter, and that followed a similar rise. GDP increased by 3.1% in the December quarter, and that followed a similar rise in the previous quarter. These back-to-back large increases are materially better outcomes than we thought we were going to see back in August. They reflect the success that Australia has had on the health front, the very large fiscal and monetary support, and the flexibility of Australians in simply getting on with their lives. And as a result, we are now within striking distance of recovering the pre-pandemic level of GDP. There's also been positive news on the employment front over recent months. You can see this in this next chart. The recovery in employment has been V-shaped, and there's been a welcome decline in the unemployment rate to 6.4%. Job vacancies, job ads, and hiring intentions remain very strong, and our business liaison program, we're hearing about firms wanting to hire again. This suggests that the unemployment rate will continue to trend lower, although this trend could be temporarily interrupted when JobKeeper comes to an end later this month. These better than expected outcomes are very welcome news. However, they do not negate the fact that there is still a long way to go and the Australian economy is operating well short of full capacity. There are still many people who want a job who can't find one, and many others want to work more hours than they currently have. And on the nominal side of the economy, we have not yet experienced the same type of bounce back that we've seen in indicators of real economic activity. For both wages and prices, there's still a long way to go to get back to the outcomes we're seeking. You can see this here. In underlying terms, inflation is running at 1.25%, and we expect it to remain below 2% for at least the next couple of years. So there's a long way back. Turning to other countries now, the recent experience has been mixed. A number are benefiting from a pickup in international trade in goods, following a shift during the pandemic to spending on goods and away from services. This shift has underpinned stronger conditions in the manufacturing sector around the world, particularly in East Asia, and it's also underpinned broad-based increases in commodity prices, which are evident in this graph. In contrast, in some other countries, virus outbreaks around the turn of the year have interrupted their recoveries, but as the people are vaccinated, we expect these recoveries to strengthen again. Looking forward across the whole globe, the rollout of the vaccines is improving global prospects for growth. In the United States, another important factor is the further significant fiscal stimulus, which amounts to 9% of GDP, which is a large number, and this comes on top of the already significant measures announced last year. The brighter global outlook has been associated with an increase in bond yields, which you can see in this next chart. This rise follows a period in which 10-year bond yields were at historic lows in many countries, including here in Australia. These historic lows reflected a combination of structural and cyclical factors. On the structural side, there has been for some time an elevated desire to save relative to the desire to invest, and the result of this has been very low real interest rates. And on the cyclical side, the steep declines in GDP, the high level of uncertainty about the future, and an expectation of a long period of very low inflation have each played a role. Recently, as the outlook improved, it's understandable that yields moved off these historic lows, although explaining the exact timing and the trigger for any change is always going to be difficult. Initially, the repricing in the bond market was associated with additional volatility in financial markets. Subsequently, conditions settled down more quickly than they did in March and April last year, although further bouts of volatility are entirely possible. This move in bond yields since November mainly reflects a lift in investors' expectations of future inflation, although there's also been some bring forward in the expected timing of future policy rate increases. This lift in inflation expectations is evident in this next chart. For most of the past year, expected inflation was well below the rates being targeted by central banks. As you can see, this has now changed, and expected inflation has moved closer to the rates targeted by central banks. This suggests that investors do have more confidence that the policy measures are working to stimulate the global economy and that the recovery will be strong enough to generate inflation close to target. If so, this would be very good news. It's also worth noting that expected inflation rates are not especially high, and they are still below, or at least not above, central bank targets. The other element in the lift in yields is the bringing forward of the timing of expected future policy rate increases. Current market pricing suggests an expectation that some central banks will increase policy rates next year and then again in 2023. This is a change from the situation just a few months ago when longer periods of unchanged policy rates were expected. This change has occurred despite inflation remaining below the threshold set by central banks for higher interest rates. Reflecting these global developments, we've seen a similar move in market expectations of future policy rates in Australia. You can see that in the bottom right-hand corner. And I'm going to return to this issue shortly when I discuss the outlook for monetary policy in Australia. Before I do that, though, I'd like to focus on one piece of the economic recovery that has been slow to click into gear, and that's private business investment. The left-hand side of this next chart shows the RBA's forecasts for non-mining business investment prepared in February last year before the pandemic, together with the actual outcomes. And the right-hand side shows the same for consumption. As you can see, the rebound in consumption has been strong, with growth of 12% over the second half of last year. For investment, it's a different story. While there was a welcome pickup in investment in the December quarter, particularly in machinery and equipment investment, investment is still 7% below the level a year ago, and it's 10% below where we thought it would be at the start of last year. Non-residential construction is especially weak, with the forward-looking indicator suggesting this is likely to remain so for quite a while yet. This weakness in business investment follows a run of years in which non-mining business investment as a share of nominal GDP was already low by historical standards. Since 2010, this investment ratio has averaged 9%. That compares with an average of 12% over the previous three decades. This is a material difference and accumulates over time to slower growth in Australia's capital stock, which has implications for our longer-term productive capacity. A durable recovery from the pandemic requires a strong and sustained pickup in business investment. Not only would this provide a needed boost to aggregate demand over the next couple of years, but it would also help build the capital stock that's needed to support future production in our economy. Stronger investment would also provide more support to a productive workforce, and it would help lift both nominal and real wages. Unfortunately, there's no magic ingredient to boosting business investment. A good starting point, though, is businesses having confidence that the recovery will be strong enough that there will be demand for their goods and services. Another important ingredient is having stable and predictable regulatory regimes, access to finance on reasonable terms is also important. And to this list, you could add businesses that are able to generate great new ideas and that have the risk appetite and the capability to back those ideas. Looking across the economy, there are investment needs and opportunities in areas as diverse as infrastructure, power generation and distribution, health and social services, food production, advanced manufacturing, digitisation and data science. So there's no shortage of ideas, no shortage of areas where additional investment would help our economy recover from the pandemic. I'd like to highlight the important role that small business has in driving investment. My colleagues at the bank have recently been examining this issue using the ABS's Blade database. One of the exercises that they've undertaken is to examine the investment and the output of firms grouped by size, so small firms, medium firms and large firms. And the results of this work are shown in this next graph. Not surprisingly, large firms account for the biggest shares of output, that's the blue bars, and investment, shown in the red bars. But small firms, on average, invest much more relative to their output than do large firms. Of course, there's a lot of variation amongst small firms, but many of them invest very intensively. In aggregate, small firms accounted for 32% of investment in Australia from 2002 to 17, while accounting for only 17% of output. So small firms do a lot of the investment. This investment drives innovation, generates new ideas, it stimulates competition, and it supports employment. So one of the important ingredients for the recovery in business investment in Australia is ensuring supportive conditions for innovative small and medium-sized businesses. I would now like to return to the outlook for monetary policy in Australia. Over the past year, monetary policy has complemented fiscal policy in cushioning the economic effects of the pandemic and in building the needed bridge to the recovery in economic activity and jobs. The RBA's policy measures have helped keep funding costs low, they've contributed to a lower exchange rate than otherwise, they've supported the supply of credit to businesses, and they've strengthened household and business balance sheets. In doing so, we've been helping in the national recovery effort. The Reserve Bank is committed to continuing to provide the necessary assistance, and it will maintain stimulatory monetary conditions for us as long as is necessary. We want to see a return to full employment in Australia and inflation sustainably within the 2-3% target range. These are our goals, and we are committed to achieving them. An important element of our policy package is the cash rate target being set at what is the effective lower bound of 0.1%. The board will maintain this setting of the cash rate target until inflation is sustainably within the 2-3% target range. It's not enough for inflation to be forecast to be in this range. Before we adjust the cash rate, we want to see actual inflation outcomes in the target range and be confident that they will stay there. This is an evolution from the approach earlier in the inflation targeting period, in which forecasts of inflation played a more central role in decision making about interest rates. We continue to pay close attention to the forecasts, but we want to see actual inflation outcomes consistent with the target before moving the cash rate. A question that investors have been grappling with recently is when will this condition for a higher cash rate be met? As I discussed earlier, over the past couple of weeks, market pricing has implied an expectation of possible increases in the cash rate as early as late next year, and then again in 2023. This is not an expectation that we share. For inflation to be sustainably within the 2-3% range, it's likely that wages growth will need to be sustainably above 3%. That's assuming that Australia continues to generate reasonable labour productivity growth and that the profit share of national income does not continue to rise. Currently, as you can see in my final graph here, wages growth is running at just 1.4%. That's the lowest on record. Even before the pandemic, wages were increasing at a rate that was not consistent with us achieving the inflation target. Then the pandemic resulted in a further step down. This step down means that we are a long way away from a world in which wages growth is running above 3%. The evidence from both Australia and overseas strongly suggests that the journey back to sustainably higher rates of wage growth will take time, and it will require a tight labour market to be sustained for an extended period. Prior to the pandemic, multi-decade lows in unemployment rates were recorded in many countries, yet even then, there was only a modest lift in wages growth and inflation. And here in Australia, even though unemployment rates in some states fell to levels last recorded in the early 1970s, wages growth remained very subdued. This commonality of experience across advanced countries suggests there are some powerful structural factors at work. These include increased competition in goods markets, the trend towards more services being provided internationally, significant advances in technology, and changes in the global supply of labour and the regulation of labour markets. Together, these factors have altered wage and pricing dynamics in almost all advanced economies, and these changes are likely to persist. This means that in the absence of another major shock, it is a long way back to seeing wage increases consistent with the inflation target. Wages, of course, are only one factor that influences inflation. We'll be reminded of this in a few months when headline inflation rate increases temporarily to 3% in the June quarter because of the reversal of some pandemic-related price reductions. Also, there are always relative price shifts occurring in the economy due to changes in the balance of supply and demand. Recent examples of this include higher prices for homewares during the pandemic, as there was very strong demand for homewares, and recently higher prices for meat as farmers rebuild their herds after the drought. We'll surely see more such examples of other sectors adjust to the altered balance of supply and demand in the economy due to the pandemic. But in setting monetary policy, the Reserve Bank Board will look through these transitory fluctuations in inflation. The point I want to emphasise is that for inflation to be sustainably within the 2 to 3% target range, wages growth needs to be materially higher than it is currently. The evidence strongly suggests that this will not occur quickly, and it will require a tight labour market to be sustained for some time. Predicting how long it will take is inherently difficult, so there is room for different views. But our judgment is that we are unlikely to see wages growth consistent with the inflation target before 2024. This is the basis of our assessment that the cash rate is very likely to remain at its current level until at least 2024. I also want to emphasise that the monetary stimulus is not just about achieving an inflation rate of 2 point something. It is just as much about achieving the maximum possible sustainable level of employment in Australia. Unemployment is a major economic and social problem, and the Reserve Bank Board places a very high priority on a return to full employment. There is inevitably some uncertainty about exactly what constitutes full employment in our modern economy. Over the past decade, the estimates of the unemployment rate associated with full employment have been repeatedly lowered, both here and overseas, so there is uncertainty. But based on the experience of the past decade or so, it is certainly possible that Australia can achieve and sustain an unemployment rate in the low fours, although only time will tell. As we progress towards full employment, we'll be relying on the wages and the prices data to provide a signal as to how close we are. The current signal is that we are still a long way away from full employment in Australia. Consistent with the judgment that the condition for an increase in the cash rate is unlikely to be met before 24, the bank remains committed to the 3-year yield target. We are not considering removing the target, and we are not considering changing the target from 10 basis points. The board has, though, discussed the question of whether to keep the April 24 bond as the target bond or to move to the next bond, that's the November 24 bond later this year. If we were to keep the April 24 bond as the target bond, the maturity of the yield target would gradually decline as time passes until the bond finally matures in April 24. The board has not yet made a decision on this question, and it will consider it again later in the year when it has more information about the economic recovery in the labour market. Later in the year, the board will also consider the case for further extending the bond purchase program. We are prepared to undertake further bond purchases if that is required to achieve our goals. Until then, we remain prepared to alter the timing of purchases under the current programs in response to market conditions. We did this last week when liquidity conditions deteriorated and bid-ask spreads in the bond market widened noticeably, and we'll do this again if it's necessary. At its recent meetings, the board has also discussed developments in the housing market, including the rising housing prices across much of the country. There are many moving parts in the housing market at the moment. We have record low interest rates, we have a shift in preferences towards houses and away from apartments, there is strong demand for housing outside our larger cities, there are very large government incentives for first home buyers and home builders. We're also experiencing the slowest population growth in a century. Time will tell how these various factors ultimately balance out, but history does suggest that shifts in population growth can have very large effects on housing prices in the country. I would like to reiterate that the RBA does not target housing prices, nor would it make sense to do so. I recognise that low interest rates are one of the factors contributing to higher housing prices at the moment, and that high and rising housing prices do raise concerns for many people in our society. There are various tools other than higher interest rates to address these concerns, leaving monetary policy to maintain its strong focus on the recovery in the economy, the recovery in jobs, and the recovery in wages. As part of our focus, we're continuing to pay close attention to lending standards, especially given the combination of low interest rates and rising housing prices. Looser standards would increase medium-term risks, and they would add to the upward pressure on housing prices, so they would be of a concern. Reflecting this, the Council of Financial Regulators has indicated that it would consider possible responses should lending standards deteriorate and financial risks increase. We are not at this point, but we are watching carefully. I'll conclude by briefly drawing together the three themes: the recovery, investment, and the outlook for monetary policy. The full recovery of our economy requires a further lift in business investment. Stronger investment will boost our productivity, and it will provide a firm basis for stronger growth in nominal and real wages. And globally, higher levels of investment relative to savings are one of the keys to return to a more normal level of interest rates over the medium term. The Australian economy is recovering from the pandemic, and we expect this recovery to continue. We're also expecting further progress towards the RBA's goals, although the journey back to full employment and the journey back to inflation consistent with the target is likely to be a long one. The RBA will maintain supportive monetary settings for as long as required to achieve those goals. Thank you very much for listening, and I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Thanks, Dr. Lowe, for that illuminating speech. I'm John Keogh, the economics editor of the Financial Review. Dr. Lowe, in your speech, you mentioned that business investment has been slow to click into gear for understandable reasons during the pandemic, but this was a problem for many years prior to COVID-19 hitting. Do you believe that the current policy settings of federal but also state governments are going to be adequate enough to get a sustained revival in business investment that you're talking about to get productivity and wages are going? And if not, as I think many in this room probably suspect, what are the sorts of policies that you would hope to see, maybe even after the next election or before the next election, once the vaccine is rolled out and maybe there's a bit more headspace to think about these things and prosecute the case for reforms?
Thank you. I don't want to comment on government policy. I think that one thing the Reserve Bank can do is try and make sure the economy is growing strongly. And I think if people in this room have confidence that the economy is going to bounce back and grow strongly, I hope that you'll invest. So that's the contribution we're making. Keeping funding costs low is also helping. And through our term funding facility, we're giving banks incentive to lend to businesses. So that's what we're doing. Got to remember, though, it's not just government that does, you know, that creates the environment for investment. Businesses actually do most of the investments. So in the past, I've drawn attention to the risk appetite of business, the hurdle rates of return, and the willingness to take risks. So this is something that all business people should be thinking about. What's the hurdle rate of return on investment in a world of very low interest rates? If you're still requiring hurdle rates of return of 12 or 15%, in the world we're living in where policy rates are zero, you're probably not going to undertake much investment, but if you lower the rates in response to lower rates on capital around the world, there are more investment opportunities. So it's not just government, it's business as well. Mm. And the Reserve Bank will do what it can do to keep funding costs low and the economy growing.
Economic history and theory suggests that if you have higher business investment, you'll get higher productivity, and that should eventually flow through to wages as well. In recent years, that's been somewhat called into question because more of the productivity gains, although they've been modest, have been going to the profit share, less to the labour share. That sparked calls for perhaps doubts about whether productivity increases are actually going to lead to higher wage increases. I mean, what would you say to that sort of naysayer sort of criticism? And it's also led to calls for perhaps more direct interventions such as a higher minimum wage or direct more rigidity in the labour market because they don't believe they can rely on the productivity gains to flow through to wages.
Well, ultimately, where does advancement in our living standards come from? It comes from better technology and doing things differently and better, doesn't it? I mean, the reason that we enjoy such a fantastic standard of living in Australia is we do things very well, we've got great technology, and that's the source of growth in our collective living standards. So there's a question at the moment about how those gains in living standards are distributed. And it does seem that over the past decade or so that workers have got less than their normal share of that. The solution to that is to have a tight labour market to get firms to have to pay higher wages to attract workers. So this is the core of our strategy, to get the unemployment rate down, create a tight labour market, and for everyone in this room to have to compete more aggressively, including pay workers more to get them. I know that's the strategy in the United States as well, under the new administration, get the unemployment rate down, have real wages increasing. And the way you get that is to having quite a tight labour market. Mm. And that's the strategy of many countries at the moment to get there. Unfortunately, we're a long way away, but we're going to stay the course until we get there here.
And just on that topic, you say in your speech that we need wages growth with a 3 in front of essentially to get inflation back into the sustainable 2-3% band. You mentioned that now you believe that unemployment could sustainably fall to the low 4s. Now, I think previously the bank's guidance on what's known as the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment was around about 4.5%, maybe a bit lower. Is that something you've reconsidered, that the NIRU might be lower? And is it even possible, there's a discussion now going on, that the NIRU might even have a 3 in front of it that might be below 4%? You might need to get unemployment below 4% to get wages growth up towards 3%.
It's entirely possible. None of us know. There's a huge amount of uncertainty here. We haven't been at such low rates of unemployment for a long period of time. And there are a lot of structural factors going on, so we can't be sure. What I'm sure of is that the unemployment rate needs to be below 5. How far below 5? It's hard to tell, and I certainly hope, and it's not inconceivable, that we could sustain an unemployment rate in Australia starting with a 3. But we're a long way from that. So we've got a bit of time to learn. We've got a bit of time to study the experience of other countries. I suspect, given the fiscal developments in the United States, they'll get down to these low rates of unemployment before us, and we'll, as we have over the past decade, see what happens there and learn lessons from it.
Mm. And speaking of the US fiscal stimulus, $1.9 trillion has just passed the US Senate. As you said, it's about 9% of GDP. I think it all adds up to about 25% of GDP if you include their previous COVID fiscal stimulus. There's a discussion now or a debate underway. Janet Yellen says now is the time to go big. Former US Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who for many years has argued that we need to do more fiscal support, is now saying this might be too big. He's raising concerns about inflation. What do you see as the implications of this huge fiscal stimulus from America for Australia and for potentially global bond markets and inflation?
For Australia, I think it means a stronger US economy, and that's going to be good for the global economy, isn't it? It's quite possible, and no one can be sure, that the US gets back to quite low unemployment rates towards the latter part of next year. There's a very large fiscal stimulus on top of what was already a large fiscal stimulus, and there's a prospect of more infrastructure spending in the United States as well. So the strategy, and Janet Yellen has talked about this, is to get the unemployment rate down. And they're spending enough money, and that could actually be the outcome here. If it is the outcome, the global economy will be stronger. That will have spillover effects to everyone else. There'll be stronger commodity prices as well. If they do get the unemployment rate down, as they hope they do, we'll be back in the world we were before the pandemic, where people will be wondering how low it can go. And does a 4% or a 3.8% unemployment rate in the United States generate inflation? I think the structural factors that I talked about are sufficiently powerful. I think even there, in the United States, they're going to have to sustain a low unemployment rate for a long time to get inflation picking up. I notice that inflation expectations at the moment in the bond market, which have risen, which is, I think, broadly a healthy thing, are still not suggesting that we're going to have a breakout of inflation anywhere. Expected inflation's increased, but it's returned to back to the target. I think that's a plausible central view, that the unemployment rate comes down in the US and they get inflation back to target, and there's not going to be a kind of a massive inflation outbreak. And Fed has said they have the tools to address it if inflation does increase. So I'm a bit perplexed by the story that we're going to have this massive inflation outbreak in the next few years.
The fiscal stimulus from the US does appear to take in some heat out of the Australian dollar. It was trading up around 80 cents a couple of weeks ago. Now it's pulled back to around 77 cents. Is that a rough level that you're a bit more comfortable about where it is now compared to it was a couple of weeks ago?
Well, the US dollar strengthened against every currency in the last couple of weeks, and so the Australian dollar has weakened, as everyone has. I'm more comfortable with lower rather than higher. I'd be even more comfortable if it was lower still, because we need to get the unemployment rate down and inflation back to target, and a lower currency would help us get there. Having said that, I cannot say the currency is overvalued. Commodity prices are very high, interest differentials are stable, so I understand why the currency is where it is. I'd like it to be lower, though. But we don't have the tools to deliver that.
Yesterday at the Financial Review Business Summit, we heard from the likes of the Future Fund Chairman, Peter Costello, raising concerns about these ultra-low and extraordinary rates potentially blowing asset bubbles. Mohamed Alarian spoke about a couple of potential market accidents that nearly happened in the bond market over the last 6 weeks, with liquidity evaporating temporarily. And generally, concerns raised about financial stability risks. Is that keeping you awake at night? Is that a primary concern for you and the RBA at the moment, with these very low rates that appear to be staying low for several years?
Our primary concern is the people who are unemployed, who don't have a job and whose wages aren't growing at sufficiently high rates. So that's, to the extent that anything keeps me awake at night, that's what worries me, that the social and economic costs from protracted period of unemployment. We know that lower interest rates do push up asset prices. That's part of the transmission mechanism. What would concern me if we saw on the back of these rising asset prices, lending standards deteriorate and people going to the bank and borrowing ridiculous amounts of money and in a speculative boom. So this is why our focus is very much on making sure these lending standards remain sound, because that would be a big problem. If we saw a debt finance speculative boom in asset prices, we are not seeing that at the moment. The equity market is below its previous peaks. Housing prices in Sydney, Melbourne, while they're rising, they're not really higher than they got to a little while back in some of the smaller capital cities in regional Australia. Housing prices are rising quickly, but there are fundamental factors at work here. So the issue is, if prices are rising, are people borrowing responsibly and carefully? And to date, they are.
Just back on the bond markets, we did see some dysfunction there globally 1 to 2 weeks ago. The RBA stepped in a bit more aggressively with some of its bond buying, both at the shorter and longer end of the curve. What do you think was the underlying cause of that? And there has been calls from some former RBA officials, academic economists, to suggest that the RBA should be doing substantially more quantitative easing at the moment because in a low inflation environment, it's basically costless. How do you respond to that?
The first part of the question was about
The bond market dysfunction.
Mm. I mean, what we saw, as I talked about in my remarks, bond yields moved from historic lows up. And we know from experience that every time there's this kind of reassessment and repricing in the bond market, there's kind of dislocation. Bid-ask spreads, spreads widen, people have trouble finding the new market price, and there's a period of dislocation. So that was what was going on. It happened in the United States, it happened here, it happened in most bond markets around the world. We stepped in during that period to help the smooth functioning of the market, and bid-ask spreads on most bonds have now narrowed again, and conditions are returning to normal. So it was really just the difficulty of adjusting to a price change. The second part of the question, if we can go on, or do you want to finish?
The suggestion that maybe the RBA should be doing more QE because some people suggest in a very low inflation environment, it's basically costless for the central bank to do that.
Yeah. Well, we're doing a huge amount already. You put together the QE and the Term Funding Facility. Each of those are roughly $200 billion. So that's $400 billion. Mm. Over a relatively short period of time, that's $400 billion. That's the injection we're making. That's very substantial. That's occurring at a time where the economy is doing better than we thought it would do. The bounce back globally and here is stronger. So we think that given the very substantial contribution we're making and the stronger bounce back, the most sensible thing to do is to see how this develops. Mm. We'll learn each month how things are progressing, and we'll understand how developments in the bond market are working out. So we're in watch and wait mode. If it turns out that we need to do more, we can, but I think right at the moment we're doing a huge amount and it's appropriate to watch and wait and see how that plays out. Mm.
You suggest there that maybe you'd be prepared to do more under certain circumstances. Is there any potential prerequisites that you'd need to see to potentially do more?
I wouldn't draw your attention to a specific kind of criteria, but the general principle is the question we're asking ourselves. Are we making sufficient progress back towards full employment and the inflation target? And can, through our policies, we accelerate that progress in a helpful way? So that's the question that at each board meeting we ask ourselves. What's the progress like? Can we do more to help that progress? That's the only kind of prism we're looking at this through.
Dr. Lowe, thanks for your time this morning. I think people would have got a lot out of that discussion and your speech. So thank you very much.
Thank you.